You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, June 13th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. What a Monday. It's no longer 99 degrees. That's nice. Turn off the AC. On the program today, just me, we will take your calls, if you are so inclined, at 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920, or you can Skype us at Majority Live. People are pretty excited. Today's not just Monday. You got my computer going? That's right. That's right, ladies and gentlemen, tonight in New Hampshire, the Republican contenders for president will jump out of their clown car and head up on stage to the for the first of the Republican debates. On the docket, Herman Cain. One wonders if he'll deliver it tonight. Michelle Bachmann, a big tip to her, always talking to the camera with the light on, not the other cameras. Mitt Romney will be in the house. Newt Gingrich, fresh off of his Newtney, where all of his campaign officials quit because they didn't want to be part of a snake oil salesman tour. Rick Santorum will be there, loving gaze, as he will. Ron Paul, of course, will be joining the field. Probably the only one up there who's held a position for more than, 4 months. And, of course, Tim Pawlenty will be there. No word as to whether or not he's going to bring a bus full of pixie dust to make the economy just be better. That's his plan, apparently. Just be better, economy. Tim Pawlenty was actually on Fox News, I guess it was yesterday, with Chris Wallace. Chris Wallace, even Chris Wallace, was like, wait a second. You're making a plan to cut the deficit by growing the economy by 5% for 10 years straight? That's never been done anywhere. Maybe in China. I mean, I suppose there was a time in this country when we were probably the Industrial Revolution. Tim Pawlenty is going to invent some. That's a great plan. Wait for the economy to grow 5% a year. I mean, you know what? We could do. We don't need to do anything, actually. That's all we need to do. This guy's a genius. Just a little preview of what you can expect tonight. I think I'm going to be watching this thing, actually. Because this should be pretty stunning stuff. Herman Cain gearing up. He's not going to get blindsided again by a tricky question on foreign policy. Things like right of return, right of return, right of return, right of return. We should. Can you pull that sound up? See if you can find that sound.
See if I can find that.
That's too precious. Right of return. Chris, right of return? That's Chris Wallace asks all the hard questions. Imagine, he should have probably just started, like, what do you think about the Mideast? The Mideast? The Mideast. The Mideast? The Mideast. The Middle East. Oh, the Middle East. Food? No, no, no. From a foreign policy perspective, what do you think of the...
We only use the finest local ingredients.
Exactly. That's right. Everything must be local. And we need to resolve this within 30 minutes or less. Here he is. And look, it's not just me making fun of him for being a bringing everything back to pizza. This is from the Daily Caller, that right-wing website. Herman Cain, the former CEO of Godfather's Pizza running for president, said he's suited to make hard foreign policy decisions because he made tough calls as a businessman. All right, fair enough. He's trying to show character. When I first became president of Godfather's Pizza, there was a very dangerous part of town in the black community where I wouldn't allow my restaurants to deliver because we had kids beat and robbed, he said in an interview outside a pizza joint here on Sunday. This is in New Hampshire. And I said, if I won't send my son over there, I'm not going to send somebody else's son or daughter over there. Last week in Omaha, Nebraska, that same neighborhood that I wouldn't deliver in, that they are delivering in now, a Pizza Hut driver was killed. Continuing on, he said, when I get ready to make a decision relative to foreign policy, I will make a decision based upon it if I'm sending my own kids, sons and daughters, into war, and I'm not going to take that lightly. Now, I appreciate that sentiment, but if you have to use an analogy about pizza delivery to talk about foreign policy, you have a large gap in your experience from which to draw on. If you have to equate the idea of sending a military forces in to a country with sending pizza delivery people into a bad part of town, you don't have any experience or even book knowledge of what you're talking about. Yes, one is dangerous and the other is dangerous. That's about where it ends. You might as well say, like, you know, I once told my son not to get on a ladder that was broken. And so I know that a ladder that's broken may fall and he could get hurt. And so that's how I'd make my foreign policy decisions, in a way that we wouldn't get hurt. It's dangerous to eat raw meat. And so I wouldn't tell somebody to eat raw meat just in the same way that I wouldn't necessarily tell someone about foreign policy, because they both could be dangerous. A Rubik's Cube is tricky. I've used a Rubik's Cube. Foreign policy is tricky. I can do foreign policy. You see where we're going with this, folks? It's not enough. I hope to God he brings this thing out tonight when talking foreign policy, because that would be a great sound clip. Moving on, Newt Gingrich, apparently every single member of his presidential election campaign team quit last week because they all realized, well, I guess Gingrich is trying to spin it like it's his wife's fault. Like somehow they were upset because his wife was involved. And he went out and said, I think it's refreshing that a couple can make these decisions together. Now, I don't know if any of you are old enough to remember way, way, way back. I mean, I think this was during the Industrial Revolution, actually. You mentioned that Bill Clinton was president. This must have been back around the time that the Constitution was written. And you recall that the right wing, led by Newt Gingrich, was enraged that Hillary Clinton was playing some part in Bill Clinton's decision-making process. Well, he goes on to say that his campaign staff couldn't handle the idea that my wife and I sit down and make decisions together. When in fact, the problem is that a political team of operatives was shocked by the flamboyance of the candidate's stumbles, his resistance to their advice, and the dire state of his campaign finances. While he was away on a lavish vacation, apparently he went on some type of like Greek cruise or something.
Yeah.
Was it in the Mediterranean?
Yeah, he was on a cruise in the
fact-finding mission. He was going to see what it would be like if you sent a pizza to Greece. So that he could actually give Herman Cain a zinger tonight. It's pretty stunning. And I think basically what happened is that the campaign staff realized, like, this is just about Newt Gingrich going around trying to make money. It's a joke. And speaking of jokes, someone tweeted that Pat Paulson, maybe somebody emailed me this. Pat Paulson was really pissed. You remember Pat Paulson was? He was in before the Common Era. That would be actually, I think, like even before the 90s. And he ran for president. He was a comedian from Laughlin. And when they wouldn't let him on the Washington State ballot, apparently he got really pissed. He called his wife because that's where how they all plan. That's how they plan their vacations. They would get the. He would write it off as a business expense because he was supposedly campaigning for president. But he's a comedian. Newt Gingrich is simply not doing the same thing, but just not funny. Just stunningly not funny. And also sharing the stage tonight, I will say this. Sharing the stage tonight will be Rick Santorum. Rick Santorum, who you'll recall, compared gays, I guess a gay relationship with that of a man on a dog relationship. Or man under a dog relationship? I'm not exactly sure.
Man behind dog relationship.
Man behind dog, man before dog. Man, I don't know.
It's complicated.
Now, but before you get the impression, oh, fair enough. I just got an eye on. Paulson was not on Laughing. He was on Smothers Brothers, which makes a lot more sense. Smothers Brothers is actually an extremely political show. And in fact, probably got canceled because Nixon had a problem with it. Rick Santorum, realizing that the days when Republicans could win simply on an anti-gay platform, nationally speaking. Of course, an anti-gay platform is probably a great way to win the Republican primary. But not so much the general election. Rick Santorum repositioning himself, as it were. Let's hear him talking to Don Lemon. I guess Don Lemon recently came out too.
Oh, I didn't know that.
I think so, right? Didn't
Yeah.
I mean, Don, I'm not outing anybody.
No, he came out.
I don't even know who Don Lemon is, other than the first time I ever became aware of him was when people were tweeting that he had came out.
Yeah, he came out recently.
So it wasn't so much a shock for me because I had no idea who he was. And so Don Lemon's asking Rick Santorum some questions. Remember, this is a man who has equated a gay relationship with bestiality. So the thing to think about when you hear this clip is not that Rick Santorum is trying to do a trying to switch positions, as it were, or that he's flipping to some other perspective. The thing to think about is who are the people he's talking about? And what do they think of themselves? Okay, play this clip.
And, do you have any gay friends?
Yeah, in fact, I've had gay people work for me.
Yeah, and friends.
Yes.
You know, people say I have black friends.
I was with a gay friend of mine just 2 days ago. I mean, so yeah, I
Hold
do.
Hold on, stop it for one second. The best is that he.
Santorum almost caught himself here by saying, like, I have black friends, too. But then he realized, like, wait a second, I better not go there, because I'm not sure. I got to double check and see who's working for me.
I like how he said he was with a gay friend just a few days ago.
Yeah, he was with. All right, let's rewind it. Well, look, you know, again, Rick Santorum is, well, I don't want to say certainly not gay. I don't know. I mean, he's presumably straight. I mean, I was going to say he's married, but that has been the prerequisite of almost any gay legislator is to be married to a woman. But that's not so much the issue. And in fact, I do recall that Rick Santorum, I think, had a gay chief of staff. But just think about that guy that Rick Santorum was with 2 days ago, his gay friend. And just how much, well, let's just listen.
I mean, yes, I was with a gay friend of mine just 2 days ago. I mean, so, yeah, I do. And they respect that I have differences of opinion on that. I talk about these things in front of them, and we have conversations about it. They differ from me, but they know that I love them because they're my friend.
Okay. Yeah.
Also. So he also talks more about that. He says, in fact, he's not a homophobe.
No, he's not a homophobe. He's not afraid of gay people. He just thinks that their sexuality is such that it would be like having sex with a dog.
Who are these gay friends that say, you know what, Rick? I respect your opinion that you think my relations are like gay sex or like sex with a dog.
Right. I respect the fact that you think I'm a second class citizen and that I fuck animals. Like what I do is like bestiality, is like some type of rape of animals, I guess. Unless you could find a willing, I guess, animal. But I mean, can an animal really give consent? I mean, what is going on in that person's mind, other than like. Let's say one of two things. I hate myself so dramatically that I am willing to subject myself and be friends with someone who thinks that I am fundamentally screwed in the head and am engaging in something that is reprehensible. Or I need to make some money. And I'm giving this guy a cover. I just don't understand the mentality. I mean, it's like a Sonder commando. It'd be worse because, you know, at least in the context of the Holocaust, Jews who would be complicit with those that thought they were like dogs, at least had, and at the very least, and for many it was probably true, like their own survival and at stake. If you're friends with someone who thinks that you should be a second-class citizen or that you engage in bestiality or what you do is like engage, then you really have some self-esteem issues. Meanwhile, Michelle Bachmann will be on stage. It is like a race to the bottom. You realize that the Republicans... As a party, not only do they wish the economy to be worse, if it can get worse, and it can, they are pursuing programs, some of them I think are just a little bit nuts, but I would think a vast majority of them are pursuing programs that they know will crush the economy. And we know that they have this disposition because if you look back on when Republicans controlled everything, when they controlled the presidency, when they controlled the Senate, when they controlled the House, they did nothing but cut taxes, run up the deficit, create this massive debt and deficit that they consider an issue. They stagnated wages. They redistributed income upward. They did all these things in the past. And they want to do the same things again at a time when we need spending. You've got Ben Bernanke delivering a speech. Every legitimate economist out there says that if you cut spending now, in an attempt to tackle the deficit now, you will tank the economy. And so when you have Mitt Romney looking to lower the corporate tax rate from 35% to 25%, remember, Bill Kristol has already admitted corporations don't need tax cuts. They have plenty of money. No one's going to go spend money on jobs if there's no demand. We've walked through this before. If I have a bakery and you give me a tax cut, I'm not going to go out and hire more people. I'm going to hire more people if more customers come in and ask for more cakes. So he wants a 10% tax cut. Tim Pawlenty, as part of his magic potion for the economy to be improved, wants a 15%, wants a cut to 15%. Michelle Bachmann, she's going for a reduction in the tax rate to 9%. She says, in my perfect world, we'd take the 35% corporate tax rate down to 9 so that we're the most competitive in the industrialized world. So businesses are going to move here. Why? What I mean, they're going to move here so that they can send their products overseas? No. No. Zero out capital gains taxes. Zero out the alternative minimum tax. Zero out the death tax. Those three taxes are essentially almost exclusively taxes that are paid by the ultra-rich in this country. She goes on to say, a system where 47% of Americans don't pay any taxes is ruinous for a democracy. Now, you hear this over and over again. There are 50% of Americans who don't pay any taxes at all. There are, in fact, about 45% of Americans who do not pay income tax. But they do pay payroll tax, FICA tax, sales tax, property taxes, and maybe some other sundry taxes. And as such, the percentage of their income that they pay in taxes is generally more than millionaires. So not only would the corporate tax rate cut cost more than $2 trillion, according to Pat Garofalo. Yes. Pat Garofalo, Janine's cousin. Second, he writes, zeroing out the capital gains tax and estate tax would overwhelmingly benefit the wealthy. 68% of capital gains taxes, are you ready for this? 68% of capital gains taxes, that means any money that you make on selling a house, over $250,000. There's no taxes on the first $250,000, unless you have multiple houses. And the far bigger bulk of it, any money that you make on selling stocks or derivatives or hedge fund monies, 68% of capital gains taxes are paid by what percentage, Evan, of this country? 68%. Which means that 68% of the capital gains wealth is being made by what percentage of Americans?
10.
10?
5.
1% of Americans control 68% of the wealth generated by capital gains. Think about that for a minute. 1%. The other 30% is scattered amongst the other 99% of the country. And I imagine if you take the first 20% of this country, the amount of capital gains by the other 80% of the country is probably in single digits. Fewer than one quarter of 1% of Americans, the richest Americans, pay the estate tax. One quarter of 1%. 0.25%. This is a perfect example of what I mean, that's what's so wonderful about Michelle Bachmann. She is just simply the naked id, I guess, of the Republican Party. If there is a Republican tonight who does not suggest that we eat the poor, or actually we feed the poor back to the middle class, then they're being fundamentally dishonest. In fact, I think it would probably be like, we're going to give some of the biggest corporations in the country a tax break if they grind up the poor into poor patties and feed them. We'll give them a huge tax break. But first, all those people have to go into prison, into the privatized prison system, stay there for 5 years so that these prisons, these privatized prisons, get paid. Then they go directly to the Monsanto or GE corporate grinding mill. They get turned into patties, and then they get fed. And all those corporations involved will get huge tax breaks for engaging in such civically minded behavior. If we don't hear that tonight as a proposal on the Republican debate, I'm going to be very pissed. To come back, we can take your call, 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. The show continues. We'll be right back. We are back. Little house cleaning for the week, folks. Today I will be on Dylan Radigan's program. Oh, and we secured that audio from the Dylan Radigan show. I think it was Crystal Count founded on Vimeo. We'll post it on the blog at Majority FM. This was the segment before Anthony Weiner. It's an okay segment. It's not earth-shattering, but it's sort of interesting. Just to see a conversation be so freeform on cable television. And we will add it sometime this week as a membership bonus. For members only, you will get the audio. So if you don't have time to go to the blog, don't bother. We will send it to you as a members only. And speaking of which, if you can become a member, we are closing in on our, what anniversary is this? The 8th month anniversary. Seventh month anniversary, I believe. Wait a second. November to December is one. December to January. January, February. February, March. March, April. April, May. June. Seventh month anniversary. And we are behind projections. Need your help if you can become a member. If you're already a member, thank you very much. You're wonderful. Those other people, you always have the potential to become wonderful. By becoming a member. And, of course, get your coffee at justcoffee.coop. Put the coupon code MAJORITY in there. Get coffee, tea, chocolate, all fair trade. Get 10% off. It's great coffee, all different types. It is a co-op, so it's you're supporting good politics, great coffee. And, of course, you can always use the Amazon link. On Tuesday, too, will be a normal show. Wednesday, still quite trying to figure out how we're going to do this, but what I'll probably do is take IMs at 11:30 on Tuesday, and then at 12, I will be filling in for Tom Hartman, both on Free Speech TV and on the radio. You can check local listings, and we will be streaming it and deliver it to you as a podcast. On Wednesday night, I fly out to Minnesota. Thursday, I will be doing live broadcasts from Netroots Nation. I will also be on the Morning Dump, which is the morning show, at least on one day, at Netroots Nations with Elon James, Liz Winstead, and Cliff Schechter. I will be doing a show from Netroots Nations on Friday. I don't know who we'll have on. We'll have a bunch of stuff. I'm going to be recording a bunch of stuff for Ring of Fire. One of those interviews will be with Al Franken, Senator Al Franken. Hopefully we'll also have an interview with former Senator Russ Feingold while I'm out there. And all of this will be delivered to you as a Majority Report member, and some of it will be delivered to you as just a Majority Report listener. So be sure to check that out. I'll have live video feeds, all sorts of stuff. And we're going to be doing a meetup Thursday night. Have we posted that location yet on the blog? We will by this afternoon. I'm not exactly sure what the location is, but we're going to be meeting up with a bunch of other podcasters and fans. Getting back to the news, the number is 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920, whatever you want to talk about. I am willing to talk about today, as it is Monday. And yes, I'm dressed nicely today because I'm going on Radigan. And I think I'm also going to be doing some, I'm not sure if I'm supposed to talk about that. January 20th, incidentally, is when Oberman's countdown on Current premieres. I'm very excited about that. Out of the Sunday Star-Ledger in New Jersey, a special unit of airport screeners charged with detecting suspicious behavior engaged in racial profiling so frequently at Newark Liberty International Airport that their resentful colleagues called them Mexican hunters. This is according to an internal federal report. Officially known as Behavior Detection Officers, or BDOs, the screeners were supposed to focus on nervous or erratic or evasive gestures or speech and other indicators to single out passengers for extra scrutiny, but instead they concentrated on whether Mexican or Dominican passengers had proper visas or passport stamps, the report said, all at the direction of their managers. It became a joke in the unit. These individuals were called the Great Mexican Hunters, said Newark BDO Paul Anime told investigators. He said, when I disagreed with these referrals and brought it up to the attention of the BDO managers, I was told by the BDO managers I was not a team player. I know that feeling. I've been told many times, not a team player. Not so much for racial profiling, but we can talk about that in the post-show. Known as the Boston Report because it was compiled by a pair of TSA inquiry officers brought in from the Boston Logan International Airport, the document is dated Jan 25th, 2010. The head of this local agency in New Jersey has already been replaced. The report said Mexican and Dominican passengers were singled out for scrutiny as an easy way to drive up the number of referrals by the network Newark's BDO unit so that it would appear productive, even though the officer's real job was to look for behavior that might indicate a security threat. This is the formula which we are also measuring the quality of education. You understand that when you build in, and in fact, it turns out there supposedly is no quota for stops, but it does create the perception of productivity. And I believe Newark was one of those airports where, in fact, I know it was one of the flights to California left from Newark on 9/11. And if you build in a system which measures the quality of the work being done in any institution by sheer numbers, then this is the type of stuff you get. Cheating. In this case, the cheating is even more reprehensible because it is racial profiling. But this is the problem with so-called education reform in this country as well. Same analogy. You're giving people an incentive not to do their job, but to do a job that makes it appear like they're doing their job. And it creates all sorts of wrong incentives. The report found that managers' emphasis on referrals created a perception among BDOs that there was a quota system in place and that promotions depended on them producing high numbers. Well, in the education reform, what we do is
kids got to do well on the test, or it looks like the teachers are bad teachers. And then you get your funding cut for the school. As such, we want to see high test numbers. Meanwhile, a new study from the Labor Department's Bureau of Labor Statistics shows that the Great Recession that technically ended in 2009 has doubled the time it takes for the average unemployed person to find a job or to simply give up for looking for work. The average unemployed person has been looking for work now for 39.7 weeks of May. The median length of unemployment rose to 22 weeks. According to a new paper by the Bureau of Labor Statistics economist Randy Lulg, the end of 2010, the median successful job search lasted 10 weeks, up from 5 weeks in 2007. For people who gave up hope of finding jobs and left the labor force, the median search in 2010 lasted 20 weeks. Before the recession started, fruitless job searches usually ended after 8.5 weeks. In 2007, 49% of job seekers found work within 5 weeks of becoming unemployed. In 2010, that number fell to 34%. And I imagine it's getting worse, not better. And meanwhile, what does the Obama administration have in its arsenal to stimulate the economy? Not much. So they are floating this notion of a payroll tax now for employers. The payroll tax pays for Social Security and Medicare. As part of the tax deal, I don't know what really the deal was so much, but the extension of the Bush tax cuts, Social Security tax was reduced by one percentage, I think it was, point. On the employee side, they want to drop it another 2 or 3 points on the employer side. This will have some minor stimulative effects, but minor. The CBO has done the numbers and has shown that the least effective way to stimulate the economy is to give tax cuts. And particularly tax cuts to millionaires, because they are much less likely to spend the money as opposed to simply invest it and speculate with it. You could lower income tax rates. You could lower corporate tax rates. The reason why payroll tax reductions, even if they are supposedly 1 year or time limited, are so nefarious is because it underfunds Social Security and creates a wonderful argument that in some way Social Security is contributing to the deficit, which it never does, except for if you purposely underfund it. And we've seen how hard it is to raise income taxes. When we know there are people with an agenda to cut Social Security, it's going to be that much harder to get rid of these tax cuts. And Larry Summers, in his tour to escape blame for failing to propose the measures necessary to get us out well beyond the prospects of a double-dip recession, has a piece, I think it was in the Washington Post or the New York Times. Does it matter? He writes, "This is no time for fatalism or traditional political agendas." His answer? Meh. Meh. "Without payroll taxes and unemployment insurance negotiated by the president and Congress last fall, we might be looking at the possibility of a double dip recession. In fact, many people think we already are, Larry. Substantial withdrawal of fiscal support for demand at the end of 2011 would be premature. But what would be that support for demand? Is it more government spending? Meh, meh. Fiscal support should, in fact, be expanded by providing the payroll tax cut to employers as well as employees. Raising the share of the payroll tax cut from 2 to 3% would be desirable as well." In other words, Let's just keep doing this on the back of Social Security as an institution. So when we get out to the other side, it'll be really easy to cut, screw over people. I, Larry Summers, I don't care. I'm a millionaire money times over. This is not an issue for me. It's not an issue for anybody that I deal with as a past president of Harvard or a business consultant, whatever it is I'm doing now. Raising the share of payroll tax cut from 2 to 3% would be desirable, as well a near-term cost of little more than $200 billion. But so much more valuable in terms of its rhetorical ability to help us cut Social Security in the future. We averted depression by acting decisively in 2008 and 2009. Now we can avert a lost decade by recognizing current economic reality. He's writing that instead of saying, we averted depression in 2008, 2009, but not necessarily going forward. On an up note, before I leave you for the post show, and we've got some news on the pot decriminalization front that Jimmy Reefcake will be very excited about. We'll talk about that in the post show. But from last week, after 11 hours of debate in Hartford, state legislators approved a bill to make Connecticut the first state in the nation to mandate paid sick leave for hundreds of thousands of service workers. House voted 75 to 65 on the bill, which had already been approved by an 18 to 17 vote in the Senate back in May. The bill applies only to businesses with 50 or more employees. It exempts manufacturing companies and nationally chartered nonprofit organizations, day laborers, independent contractors, and temporary workers. So it's a start, folks. It's just a start. The measure covers only service workers who receive an hourly wage, 200 to 400,000 of them in New York, in Connecticut. Including waiters, cashiers, fast food cooks, hairstylists. Governor Malloy said this is good public policy. Why would you want to eat from food from a sick restaurant cook? Or have your children taken care of by a sick daycare worker? The answer is you wouldn't, and now you won't have to. Good news in Connecticut. I hope that spreads. Also, this is an update. Checks out. We had mentioned the story about the Chamber of Commerce attempting to forestall a Dodd-Frank rule by the SEC that pays corporate whistleblowers if they bring to the attention of their corporation and the SEC securities violations, any type of accounting fraud, et cetera, et cetera. And that rule passed. SEC would pay up to 30% of the money it recovers from a company or person in terms of fines. Divided, SEC voted 3-2 to adopt the new whistleblower program. The two Republican commissioners objected.
Surprise, surprise.
Program was mandated by the financial overhaul law enacted last year. The new rules will take an effect in about 60 days. They discourage employees from bypassing their company's compliance programs. Once employees report potential wrongdoing to their company, the SEC would officially designate them as whistleblowers, however, potentially eligible for awards and to give them some type of protection. The SEC will credit whistleblowers whose companies pass their information on to the agency, even if the whistleblowers themselves do not. So this is good news. Uncovering a whistleblower, corporate fraud. And finally, consumers may be unaware, and for those of you, insurance programs that have been denied coverage, this may be helpful to you. Millions of Americans gained the right this year to appeal decisions made by health plans to an outside independent decision maker. Federal officials say beginning this year, about 44 million people are entitled for the first time to an external appeal. Under 2010 healthcare law, they are enrolled in self-insured health plans offered through an employer that weren't grandfathered or exempted under the Affordable Care Act law. In an external review, basically the place to check on this, head to Families USA online, and you can find information there if you are eligible to appeal decisions by your health plan
that don't cover certain things. We've got to take a break. We will head to the post show. You can call me at 646-257-3920. I am me at Majority FM. Please join me in the post show if you can. If you can't, that means you're either not listening live or you're not a member. And you do not know what you are missing. And you shan't know until you become a member. See you on the flip side.